Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we meet British writer Anthony Horowitz. Horowitz is popular among different audience groups for very different things. For young male listeners, for example, he's known for his very popular and best-selling Alex Rider series of spy novels, the last of which has just been released, Russian Roulette. The series has also spawned a motion picture, Stormbreaker, for which he adapted the screenplay. To a PBS audience, he's known as the writer and creator of Foyle's War, a very popular British television detective drama focusing on the crime-solving abilities of Detective Chief Superintendent Christopher Foyle, set in World War II and post-war Britain. The eighth series aired on PBS's Masterpiece this past fall, and the ninth series begins production this year. To devotees of Sherlock Holmes, he's known as the author of The House of Silk, the first Holmes novel authorized by the Conan Doyle estate, and he's busy working on another Holmes-related novel as well. Anthony Horowitz joins us today to talk about the recurring popularity of Sherlock Holmes, his ongoing television work for Foyle's War, and how his character Alex Rider was inspired by Ian Fleming's James Bond books. Anthony Horowitz is my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Anthony Horowitz, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's a great pleasure, Rich. Thank you.
You are an incredibly prolific writer, working in everything from feature film to television to books, not only your best-selling Alex Rider young adult books, which the 10th of which is Russian Roulette, but writing Sherlock Holmes mysteries in the Arthur Conan Doyle estate, authorizing you to do that. I assume you're just sort of balancing different things. Is that a help to your writing, going from project to project, or do you like to focus on one at a time?
Well, I certainly never do two projects in one day. If I'm writing Foyle's War, for example, I'll stick to Foyle's War all day, or if I'm doing Alex Rider, that's an Alex Rider day. If I try to mix the two of them together, who knows what sort of accident's going to happen on the page. So I try to keep everything in separate compartments. But the overall picture is that I am very, very fortunate to be able to do all these different things because, for me, writing is an adventure and it's a journey. And the most important thing of all is to keep myself fresh, to keep myself challenged, to keep doing new things. And so, you know, if I feel bored or whatever, writing a novel or just run down on that, I can switch over to a TV or to a theater or to even journalism. And that helps, I think, keep me fresh.
Now, Alex Rider, as I understand it, came out of your own love of James Bond.
James Bond was very
important to you growing up, wasn't it?
Well, I was at a pretty horrible school when I was a kid, and I was quite unhappy there, and it was a very drab, very cruel, abusive environment. And the one big event in the year for me, and I still remember it as a kid, was going to the James Bond movies. At that time, of course, only in one movie theater at a time. You had to stand in the rain in order to get your ticket, which I always did for 2 or 3 hours. And this was sort of the big highlight of my year. And then, you know, I started with Sean Connery, then Roger Moore. Roger Moore got older and older in the part, so by the end of it, he was 57 years old. And around that time, I thought, I had this thought, you know, this guy is too old to play the part. Wouldn't it be great if Bond was a teenager again? And it was one of those sort of light bulb moments that created Alex Rider, who is not James Bond, but who is a teenage spy. And there are some similarities, although I then worked hard to make him as different as possible. But without any doubt, the books by Ian Fleming and the movies were my first inspiration.
What came first, the books by Ian Fleming or the movies?
But I think more or less at the same time, I remember reading the books at school. These days, they're slightly frowned upon, the books, because they are quite violent. Ian Fleming's attitude to women is not really, doesn't chime with our modern feelings and sensibilities. They have quite a racist tone to them, even an anti-Semitic tone to them as well. But I still think they are superbly well written. I think he is a terrific writer, even an underrated writer. But I was reading the books and watching the movies at sort of the same time, and the whole ethos of it. There never had been a spy like Bond before. It made a huge impression on me.
You know, what's really interesting is how the film series is now reinventing Bond, and we're learning more about his background than we ever knew, really, until Craig started playing the part. And, of course, the books do a little bit more of that. Was that important in forming your own character of Alex Rider?
I think the great thing about Alex Rider has been the fact that, first of all, I've written him for 10 years, you know, from Stormbreaker, the very first book, up to Russian Roulette. So, you know, that's 10 books and about 10, maybe even 12 years of writing. And the more I've written him, the more I've had the opportunity to explore him, to explore his background, his family, what made him what he was, all that sort of stuff. And it's quite interesting now that over a long series, you sort of, a character just becomes richer and deeper, and you begin to ask more and more questions about them, and the end result is something which is just more than a children's hero. It is a fully rounded human being, and I've enjoyed that process very much.
Well, in Russian Roulette, it's really the story of two secret agents, one good, one evil. What was the origins of this particular book, Russian Roulette?
Russian Roulette is about a Russian assassin called Yasin Grigorovich, and readers of Alex Rider will know that he turns up in Stormbreaker, this character, as an adult, and he's also in Eagle Strike, and he's in Crocodile Tears. He sort of is always there as Alex's nemesis, his worst enemy throughout the books. And after I finished writing the series with Scorpio Rising a couple of years back, I suddenly realized I wanted to explore this other character as well, to look at the bad guy. Because I think that what is interesting to me, first of all, is that there are no children's books that I know of that have taken a bad character as the main protagonist in a story. It's an interesting thing to do. You think about Harry Potter, you think about Artemis Fowl, you think about Alex himself. These are all heroes. Is it possible to write a book about a villain? That was the first question. The second question, can we understand that villain? Is it, you know, people who do bad things in this world, they began as children. One day they were young, you know, they were young once too. And I think it's an interesting thing to try and look at these people and to try and humanize them, to find some kind of compassion for them and to see them as fully rounded human beings rather than merely sort of figures of evil.
Is writing these Alex Rider's stories still enjoyable? I know some people, as they go through a series, they say, you know, I'm tired of doing this. And sometimes they just can't stop it. Are you still finding new things to reveal about this character? Obviously, you're taking a different tack.
You know, the honest truth, Rich, is that I've stopped. I mean, I always decided I would only do 9 Alex Rider stories. In fact, I wasn't even going to do as many as that. And I stopped for precisely the reason you're talking about. I never wanted to write an Alex Rider book that felt tired or formulaic or predictable. I never wanted to write the book that kids read and then said afterwards, you know, it's not quite as good as the last one. I rationed myself rigidly. I said Alex Rider would only have adventures while he was 14 years old. Now, he had a very busy year. He saved the world 9 times. But even so, that made it, you know, that there was a limit to the number I could do. And with Russian Roulette, this sort of visiting Yasin Grigorovich as a killer, I've come full circle. I've stopped.
Now, do you think you'll ever come back to Alex when he's an adult at some point?
You know, it's something I have thought about. I'd be quite interested. I do write adult books, too. And I would be quite interested in looking at Alex's age, shall we say, at the end of his 20s, you know, post-college, to see what all the adventures have done to him. You know, so many bad things happen to Alex in the course of these books. You know, a 14-year-old boy up against these terrible, world-dominating villains.
And he's lost his entire
so many
family.
Bad. Yeah, that's right. So, you know, it would be quite interesting to see what he becomes as an adult. And as far as I know, nobody's done that again, you know, to take a character out of children's books and to revisit them as grown-ups. And that, to me, is what the fun of writing is about. It's about doing things that haven't been done and exploring new avenues.
Now, one of the things you do in the Alex Rider books is you explore the science of the gadgets. That must be really interesting to learn about.
I love doing that. I mean, the kids these days are so, you know, they're so savvy. They know what works and what doesn't work. And I have to get all the facts right. So whenever I write anything in the books, whether it's, you know, nanotechnology, which is in one book, or cloning, which is a subject of another, I do a great deal of research to make sure that I'm getting everything right. When it comes to the gadgets, the rules are simple. One, they shouldn't be too violent or lethal. I'm not interested in sort of excessive violence in these books. Teachers and librarians and parents don't like it, and I know that to reach my audience, the violence has to be very carefully, you know, kept at a certain level. So nothing too nasty. And the second thing is they've got to be scientifically possible. You know, again, going back to James Bond, I remember a movie that had a motor car in it. It was invisible, the invisible car. I think it was one of the Pierce Brosnan ones. I can't remember. But anyway, the moment that car was on the screen or not on the screen, to me, the whole credibility of the movie disappeared because we know it's not possible. So the gadgets have to be fun, non-lethal, and scientifically possible.
My guest today is Anthony Horowitz. His latest book is the 10th and the final one, it sounds like, in the Alex Rider series, Russian Roulette, The Story of an Assassin. And he is also the creator of Foyle's War, which we see here in America on PBS's Masterpiece. He's also written Sherlock Holmes, one book already, The House of Silk, that came out a couple years ago. He's busy working with Steven Spielberg on the sequel to The Adventures of Tintin, and very, very busy in general. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. I want to ask you about Foyle's War, because unlike Alex Rider, and that is the convention, is your protagonist stays eternally young. In the case of Foyle's War, you have gone through history, starting at the very beginning of World War II in the first series. Now, the last series to air was in the Cold War. You've let these characters grow up, and that sort of breaks a convention.
Well, it was the only way I could do it. I mean, when I started thinking about doing a detective series set against the Second World War, I had to begin at the beginning. And in fact, from the point of view of Britain, Britain in 1940 is the most extraordinary place. What I learned from the research, and I did a ton of research for this series, was how close we came to losing the war. In 1940, long before you and your countrymen came to our assistance, arriving, if I may say so, a touch late in the day, but we're still grateful for your intervention nonetheless. 1940, we are inches away from defeat, and the mood in the country is one of stark fear, you know, cloud formations in the sky. People will phone the police because they think it is enemy parachutists and the invasion has begun. So I began in 1940, and then just season after season, we moved forward chronologically as the mood changed, and America enters the war, and the tide turns against Hitler, you know, the second front in Russia happens, and all that sort of stuff. But nonetheless, it is an ongoing story, and there is, I think, in the Second World War, a very strong line you can draw through it of people's psychology, their attitude. And then, of course, you come to 1945, and the war is suddenly over. And that has a profound effect on people, too. For one thing, for Foyle, for my character, he's no longer a policeman. He's left the police force, and suddenly he's in the Cold War, and the new enemy is no longer the Nazis. It is Stalin's Russia. And that's what we've now done with the series. We've gone from, we've completely, really reinvented ourselves, as Foyle is now working in special operations. He's a spy rather than a detective. And we're now talking sort of John Le Carré rather than whatever we were before. And that, to me, has been a wonderful thing to do because it's reanimated us. It's given us new vitality, new characters. Ellie Harrington, incidentally, absolutely wonderful as our M figure, sort of our Judi Dench. and it's a whole new world for me to play with.
Is Michael Kitchen still up for doing this series? Because it seemed like, you know, I mean, it had run its course as World War II ended. And now, of course, as you say, it's reinvented. I guess everybody's involved.
We couldn't do it without Michael Kitchen. We couldn't recast that part. I mean, he is the absolute... He and Honeysuckle Weeks, he plays his driver and his sort of sidekick, Samantha Stewart. The two of them are absolutely the heart of the show. And if either of them decided to leave, you know, I wouldn't even try to continue without them. I think what's wonderful is that, you know, we have had this immensely long relationship now. We've been going for three times as long as the war itself, because we wrote the first episode, or I wrote the first episode in 2000, and here we are in 2014. It's a long, long time together. But it's been a wonderful learning process. You know, Michael creates that character with me, and he has developed that character with me. It's very much a sort of a collaborative show.
Well, one of the things I really appreciated about the World War II episodes was the amount of research you went into, because you told stories that probably even some Britons themselves, and certainly Americans, as they watched the show on PBS, were unaware of, like the fact that not everybody was all in it together. The rich had their little enclaves out where Foyle's posted. He's posted on the south of England, but it's a rural area. And there were these little estates where they basically were untouched by the war. That was probably an episode that touched a key nerve. British fascists were another part of another episode. These are things that really have kind of gotten lost in history.
Well, Rich, you know, I'm so grateful to you for saying it. Thank you very much, because to me, the great pride I have in Foyle's War, the pleasure of it, is so many stories that we have unearthed, which are true stories which nobody knows. I tell you, you know, you're referring there to the Funk Hole, which was an episode we did, I think about the third or fourth season, these places like hotels where, you know, the rich could go and basically hide from the war. They were called funk holes. Funk is another word meaning cowardly or fearful. So that was something I didn't know about until I found it in the book. There were also people in Stanley who were so scared of the bombings that they went and lived in their cars, in their automobiles. They would park them in the woods outside the city and sleep there overnight so that they wouldn't get bombed. And And that's something we do. You know, we have a murder story in which there is a witness because he happens to be sitting in his car in a wood. And I think the fun of Foyle's War for me, yes, it's a murder mystery. I love a good murder and a good set of clues and suspects. But for me, the excitement of the series and what got me going were these extraordinary stories. You know, we did a story about the birth of plastic surgery. And that in itself is an amazing story of both heroism and ingenuity and comradeship. It's a story that needs to be told. And it's because we are a murder mystery show, because people will watch us simply for the fun of a detective solving a crime, that we can almost get away with telling these amazing stories as well.
Now, as you mentioned, the series has sort of reinvigorated itself as a Cold War series. And what has been interesting is to already see that amazing change that happened at the end of World War II as allies became enemies. And, of course, in Britain especially, there was a heavily socialist element, and you had people picking sides, some abandoning their ideals as far as socialism goes and still being persecuted anyway, as well as those who continue to work for communism. So it's really interesting to watch that sort of paranoia that we think of the McCarthy era also infect somewhat Britain as well.
I think definitely there is a comparison to make with McCarthyism. I mean, there was a great deal of mistrust, you know, of people like George Orwell and the BBC and organizations of being infiltrated by Russians. And we didn't take it as far as McCarthy did in America, of course. But that's absolutely correct, that this atmosphere of mistrust and of fear. And of course, you've got the atomic cloud hanging over everybody now as well. You know, the atomic bomb tests, which we actually dramatized in an episode called The Eternity Ring, made a profound difference to the way people viewed warfare and people viewed their future. This is the beginning of sort of the nuclear terror that continues all the way up to the Cuban crisis. And you're right, there are so many different things happening. There are the spivs coming in, the sort of the gangsters who are profiteering from the war. The stories I'm writing at the moment look at Zionism. We've got Zionist terrorists now because of Mandatory Palestine. The new episode I've just finished writing last week is set against the bombing of the King David Hotel, in which 23 British people were killed. And suddenly you've got an enemy, but it's come out of nowhere. The Zionists, the Jews, you know, extreme Jews. So I think it is fascinating. Added to which, incidentally, in this country, you've got the sense of why we just fought this war. You know, we expect suddenly to be wealthy, to be happy, to be prospering, but we're not. Suddenly everything is still very tight, the rationing is still there, people can't get the food things they want, they can't seem to get any pleasures out of life. So there is this enormous sense of disappointment and a sense almost of futilism about the whole war, which again is very interesting and it very much informs the new series.
Well, you know, it's interesting for Americans, the end of the war brought unbridled prosperity, but we always forget that in the UK, rationing continued for another 10 to 15 years.
You know, I was born in 55. Rationing finally finished 2 years before I was born in 53. And there was no bread rationing at all in the war, but after the war, bread got rationed. I mean, you know, this was a big, deep shock to the British psyche. The people and people couldn't understand what it had all been for.
Well, we'll look forward to that next series of Foyle's War. My guest today is Anthony Horowitz, who is the creator of Foyle's War, the series for the BBC and for PBS on Masterpiece. He's also the author of the Alex Rider series. His latest book and final book in that series is Russian Roulette. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. But not only are you involved with Alex Rider, you're also involved with Sherlock Holmes. The Arthur Conan Doyle estate authorized your book, The House of Silk, which came out a couple of years ago. I understand you're working on a sequel. And first of all, before we talk about your involvement with Sherlock, what has led to this incredible interest in Sherlock? You know, you have the BBC series Sherlock, you have Elementary here in this country, you have the Sherlock Holmes films, which are somewhat Sherlocky.
That's slightly Sherlocky, yes. When I talk about the movies, I always say they're a bit Indiana Holmes.
Yes, exactly. but what has led to this resurgence into this character? What do you think? Is it something that's happening now, or is it just cyclical?
I think it's cyclical, actually. I mean, I don't think there's ever been quite so much Sherlock Holmes at one time. That is a sort of the strange thing, you know, to have a major series of feature films, two television programs, although the Elementary was a sort of a spin-off of Sherlock, which is the modern version in Britain, and my book at the same time. It's almost like British buses, which they always say, you know, you wait for one for an hour, and then three come at once. But Sherlock Holmes has always been the father of modern detectives. I mean, Arthur Conan Doyle invented the detective novel, effectively. There had been one or two before him, but it was he who had the sort of bright idea, for example, of bringing the two people together, the utterly brilliant, slightly cold, forensic character that is Sherlock Holmes, with a very genial, less clever, though far from stupid, Dr. Watson. And that relationship is what makes those books work so well. And many, many detective writers, including, for example, Agatha Christie, who had Hercule Poirot with Captain Hastings, were used exactly that same formula. The stories, there aren't that many of them. It's a funny thing, there are only something like 56 short stories altogether and four short novels, but they have this extraordinary grip on the public, a little bit like James Bond in a funny way. I can't think of many literary characters who have managed to appeal to generation after generation and after generation and who never seem to die.
You know, you mentioned the buddy story. I mean, that's such a Hollywood convention now, and it's interesting to think that maybe it originated with Sherlock Holmes because, you know, the movies from the 30s, that wasn't a buddy situation. I think the TV series today and, of course, the books reflect that more.
No, in a way, it's obvious, because how do you get inside the head of the main character?
Especially if he's cold.
Give him someone to talk to. You know, the friend that he can be a sounding board with. So that is how the books work. But it is a unique friendship. You know, I've often said that Sherlock Holmes and Dr. John Watson have the greatest literary friendship. And when I reread the stories and reread the books, that's what always strikes me. It's not so much the mysteries and the clues and the crimes, although they are very entertaining and very well done. It's this extraordinary friendship. And when I was offered the job of doing this book, and I thought to myself, gosh, is it really something I want to do? Do I really want to get involved with Holmes when there is so much of it around at the moment? The temptation, the idea of spending time at 221B Baker Street in the company of these two friends and being part of their circle for the 6 months it took me to write the book was irresistible, and that's why I did it.
And that was The House of Silk, and I guess
The House of Silk, the sequel will be out in October, although I have to say that in the sequel, which I finished a couple of weeks ago, in fact, Sherlock Holmes barely appears. Having done it once, having done the absolute straight Holmes-Watson story once, I felt I couldn't do it again exactly the same. So although it has some characters out of the Sherlock Holmes world, some of them very well known, Holmes himself this time has gone. He's fallen over the Rickenbach Falls and he's disappeared. I hope it's as twisty and as fun as the first one.
Now, I was reading an article about you. You said you have 10 rules for writing Sherlock Holmes. And there's some really interesting rules. One is no over-the-top action. I think that throws the films right out.
Sherlock Holmes, I like the films. I do enjoy
them. I do too.
I don't think they have a great deal to do with the books, but they work on their own, in their own way, and I think that Downey and Jones and Jude Law are terrific together, so I've got nothing against them. But in the book, I didn't want to get into that sort of over-the-top action. It is true, incidentally, that Sherlock Holmes is a swordsman and a pugilist. He can box, and he knows judo. So it's not unfair to say to think of him as an action man, but broadly speaking, Conan Doyle never gave him major action sequences.
And one of the other things is no women.
The thing there was that, you know, that in the Scandal in Bohemia, which is one of the very, very first, it's in the Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, the very early Sherlock Holmes novel, Conan Doyle says quite explicitly for Holmes there was only one woman, and that woman was Irene Adler, whom he sort of idolized and sort of loved from afar, and she then disappears and he remains utterly celibate and very much the bachelor. So because Doyle had said that, I thought it would be an intrusion to invent a love interest for Sherlock Holmes, which others have done, and you know, some have even suggested that, you know, some have questioned his sexuality, some pastiches have invented women for him to fall in love with. I decided to stick with what Doyle had instructed.
One of the other rules was do the research and use the right language. And, of course, the language, a lot of words have changed since the Victorian era, and probably some of the meanings have changed of the words that remain.
Well, words, language changes all the time, of course. But yes, in the writing of the book, again, I had to stick very much with a sort of a 19th century feel to it. But at the same time, because the book was read by both, you know, adults and by young people who knew my other works, the Alex Rider books, I didn't want the book to become too stylized, so that actually would stop people enjoying the reading. It had to sort of embrace what, you know, what modern people expect, or modern readers expect. But I think I did it, I hope I did it quite well, because I read a lot of 19th century literature. Dickens is my favourite author. I love Thomas Hardy, Jane Austen, and Anthony Trollope, all 19th century writers. So I'm sort of very, very familiar with that style of language. And incidentally, I love the English language. You know, I just love the way the words fall on the page. And when I read a 19th century novel, I love the sort of the sound that they make. And I did try to sort of replicate something of that.
Of course, in this particular book, the House of Silk, it is one of the last stories that Watson's is telling, although the events happened early in their friendship, which is that's an interesting conceit. He says this was just too terrible to put down until now.
There were lots of reasons for doing that in the book. The first is that if this is an unknown, like if the House of Silk is an unknown Sherlock Holmes story, why is it suddenly coming into print now? So the answer is it's got something in it so horrible that Watson has put it into a vault for 100 years for a future audience. And it is true that the story of the House of Silk, the secret at the heart of it, is a very dark secret and in many ways a very modern secret. But also having an older Watson allowed me to do two things. The first one is language again. It meant that if he was writing it right about 1912, then already his language would have become more modern, and I wouldn't need to be quite so sort of, you know, rotund and so sort of, you know, decorative as the original language would be. And also, because he's an older Watson, he can be more reflective. He can think about things that the younger Watson describing the adventures in Doyle's world might not have thought about. It's interesting, for example, but in none of the Sherlock Holmes stories does Doyle talk about poverty in London and starvation and the fact that there were destitute children on the streets and all that sort of thing. You know, he's got the Baker Street Irregulars, a gang of street children who help Sherlock Holmes, but he never considers what has driven them into sort of poverty and desperation. And so the later Watson, when he's now thinking back to his childhood, can reflect more on those sort of social issues of the time.
All right. Well, we wish you great success with that new Sherlock Holmes book coming out, I guess, next fall. Is that right?
About next fall. That's right, yes.
All right. And when will the next edition of Foyle's War come out?
Well, we shoot through till about April, May. After that, it's up to I don't know, PBS or to the networks here as to when it actually gets slotted for transmission. These things do seem to take an eternity to reach the screen.
All right. Well, we wish you great success with that. And we'll also look forward to the sequel of The Adventures of Tintin, which I guess is under development at this particular point.
Ongoing development. That's right.
All right. Well, Anthony Horowitz, thanks very much for your time today.
It's been a pleasure, Rich. Thank you.
British writer Anthony Horowitz speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He's the author of numerous novels, but best known for his popular Alex Rider series of spy novels, the latest of which is Russian Roulette, The Story of an Assassin. He's also the creator of several different television series, including PBS masterpieces Foyle's War. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just find Studio Tulsa and you can look through our archives over past episodes that you might have missed a part of. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.